If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Schoenbrunn, and I'm your host. I have a very, very, very special guest with me today. None other than Julius Winfield Irving, better known as Dr. J. Dr. J, internationally recognized, was the dominant basketball player of his era and a true innovator who revolutionized the way the game was played. Widely heralded as one of the all-time greats, he is often considered to have been the catalyst for the ABA-NBA merger in 1976. Irving's strong leadership skills led his teams to championships in both leagues, while his authentically thrilling, high-flying style on the court captivated millions of fans from all over the world along the way. He was the epitome of class and humility, and no one was more respected both on and off the court. Irving played professionally for 16 years, having scored 30,026 points in his combined ABA and NBA career, and left as the third highest scorer in professional basketball at the time, behind only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Will Chamberlain. Irving scored more than 22 points per game in his 11 NBA seasons with Philadelphia and 28.7 points per game in his 5 ABA seasons with Virginia and New York. In 1993, Irving was elected to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame and was also named to the NBA's 50th anniversary all-time team. In 1994, Irving was named by Sports Illustrated as one of the 40 most important athletes of all time. In 2017, GQ Magazine selected him as part of the 50 greatest living athletes, a true testament to his staying power of remaining generationally relevant some 30 years after his playing career ended. Irving holds a degree in business management from the University of Massachusetts, as well as honorary degrees from Temple University and Philadelphia University. He is the founder of Irving Global Opportunity LLC, and he brings to the table close to 40 years of experience as a Hall of Fame player, executive, and entrepreneur. He has also served on various boards of directors. Please help me welcome Dr. J. Julius Irving.
Thank you so much. That is a rousing introduction. If I was going to correct one thing, I think when they mentioned GQ, I thought you were going to mention something about fashion, but that didn't happen. So we just have to work that in next time.
Oh, so why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
About fashion? Yeah. Well, I tried to be a pace setter in the 70s. It was bell bottoms, high platform shoes, high hair, the whole nine yards. And then it shifted very quickly into the 80s and 90s to something a little more conservative looking, but colorful nonetheless. And here we are in the 2000s and 2020s or whatever. So, what am I representing? Win of Las Vegas?
I got to tell you, I remember when you hit the scene. I was young. I'm a little younger than you are. But I was about 15 years old when you came on the scene. And I just remember, watching you in such awe. That it was incredible. I had Sports Illustrated, and all the pictures, the whole spread that they did on you with the big afro. You had the big afro at the time. My favorite, there are a couple of favorites that I have, but one of my all-time favorites was watching you slam dunk over Jabbar. That to me was just so amazing. I'm like, whoa, this guy can do anything. All right. So as far as I'm concerned, you are, if not the best, you are certainly in the top 3 to 5 of all time. I mean, you are my hero.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when they combined both leagues, the things that were done should add up to, having a very elevated status in terms of all time best. And it's been an uphill battle just in terms of getting the ABA the recognition that it deserves. But I think this commissioner is on to it, and probably on his watch, he'll be able to do some things that David Stern just wasn't able to do. Not that he didn't want to do them, because we had multiple conversations over the years, about the recognition of the ABA and the merging of the statistics and, you know, stuff like that. So I think Adam Silver gets it and wants something significant to be done on his watch. Even with the players who haven't done well, who were former ABA players, and, you know, some of them are destitute. Some of them are dying broke, can't afford funerals or whatever. And the pension situation has never been resolved. So those guys, some guys put in 9 years or whatever, and that would make a difference just in terms of, you know, they're moving on to the next stage of their existence and also in terms of their family benefiting. So there's a lot of dialogue going on about that. And that's, you know, one of the things that preys on my mind sometimes when I go to sleep. Will there ever be justice for all, particularly, you know, the ones who are our fallen brothers?
Wow. Wow. You know, and probably most people don't even know this. All right. So yeah. I'm glad you brought that up also. And I think we'll go into that in a little bit later in the show. But I want to start with, I mean, I can't believe next month it's going to be 13 years since the mission that we went on together to Israel, to the Holy Land. Do you remember that? I know that for me and my son, studying to be an actuary.
Really?
Yeah. And at the same time, studying to be a rabbi. I don't know which direction he's going to go, but whatever he does, you know, I wish him well.
Yeah.
So
yeah, me too.
I just want to start there. My first question to you is really, what kind of an impact did that trip to Israel have on Dr. J?
Well, you know, it wasn't my first trip there. And hopefully it won't be the last. It's the last right now, but hopefully there'll be another trip worked in somewhere along the lines. And just been able to go to the Holocaust Museum to pray once again at the Wailing Wall and to go into Church of the Nativity. And, you know, the tourist destinations, which are more than tourist destinations because they're part of spiritual history for all the religious sects. And we found and we exploited and enjoyed the fact that when we went in some places, there was representation for many of the different religious sects, and that was important. I think from a family perspective, for us to meet the political leaders of the day, and you know, be involved in conversations about the issues of the day. You know, that was meaningful. And, you know, I think we were ambassadors for the U.S. And at least the boys were. The girls probably just got a little shopping in and enjoyed the scenery. But Rick and I, you know, I think have taken very seriously that time when we were there and not taking it for granted, and come home with a lot of conversations with our friends and our relatives, and made it a sharing experience and encouraged them to go and see what all of us was about. Because, you know, because we did enjoy ourselves and we learned so much, you know, and we were so influenced by the rabbi and the other rabbis that we met, and the fact that, you know, they welcomed us with open arms and talked very candidly, and, you know, just kind of let us know what was going on and what time it was.
Yeah, I'll tell you, one of the things that humbled me personally, and I still have that image in my mind, all right, was watching you at the Wailing Wall. And when you knelt down at the Wailing Wall, I mean, it sent shivers down my spine. You know, I look at you, the world looks at you, you're this iconic individual, all right? And then you get to the Wailing Wall, you humble yourself by kneeling at the wall. I mean, it was so amazing. It's a picture that, like I said, in my mind, that I will never, ever forget. I mean, it was amazing. And we did have a good time. All right, let's be real. My son Avrami He was so funny. All he wanted to do was get your autograph. And I kept telling him, I said to him, Avrami, just wait. It was like the first day, day one. And I said, Avrami, just wait. And then at the end of the trip, you gave him a basketball and you signed, we have it here. And I never forget the inscription. It's basically from Dr. J, and it's to Avrami, great hanging with you and your dad. Thanks so much. Dr. J, you know, so that meant so much to him as well. So it was twofold. It was meeting Rabbi Grossman, which was very, very, very exciting and very, I mean, it's humbling to see what this man has done. So that was, well, so I'm you glad.
You see the residents for the people that are being housed, and you know, I mean, as far as living conditions go, it's not like Four Seasons Hotel or anything like that or whatever. I mean, it's plain and simple and it's functional. And, you know, for them to live there and know that they're being taken care of, and for them to focus on, you know, what's next for them, you know, where they're going to go in life. Because, you know, many of the young people going to the military, you know, by requirement.
Right.
To do 2 years, I believe, or go to the farms and go to the kibbutz and so on and so forth. So learning about that in terms of the culture or whatever, I think that was important. And that's important to bring back home and talk to our kids about. And then for your son to experience it firsthand and know that could be him.
Right. Right. I mean, the one thing that I really was impressed with my son is that was his bar mitzvah trip. And he made a decision because, you know, he'd been talking about this bar mitzvah party. You know about the bar mitzvah parties, right? Everybody's does bar mitzvah parties.
Been invited to a few.
And that's all he talked about the entire time he was 12 years old. That's all he talked about, him and his friends. Oh, the bar mitzvah party. And when I approached him, when somebody approached me about this mission, and then, you know, going on this meeting, and I approached him and I said, look, to me, it's going to cost the same amount of money. So it doesn't really matter to me. All right. But what would you want to do? Do you want to have this party? Do you want to go on this mission to Israel? And he said, Dad, give me a week to think about it. And he came back and he said, no, I want to do the mission. And I was so blown away because it was so meaningful. It's something that he'll carry with him the rest of his life. You know, the parties that come, they go, but this was, and I was so proud of him that he did that. So,
He was able to make some new friends too.
Yeah.
Instead of just hanging out with the old friends.
Absolutely.
You can hang out with them anytime, but make new friends like me and Rick and the girls and the other people who we met along the way. I mean, you know, we did meet some very interesting people.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to tell you about, you know, my journey with Moshe Feldenkrais. And he trained me for several years at a very pivotal time in my career. And he lived in Israel up until the time that he died. And he was an amazing guy who, you know, they have books about him. And he was involved with colleges here in the United States, just in terms of teaching the Feldenkrais method, and which is a way of making your being better. You know, you become a better being by utilizing the things that he espouses on and whatever. So he was, you know, he was a giant among giants. And for me, I mean, and he only came up to my chest. The first time I met him, it was like in Springfield, Massachusetts. And he says, you know, you're a big guy, but I could break you in half if I wanted to, you know, because he was like a judo expert. He said, but I heal people. But I heal people now. So, you know, that was one of my trips to Israel, was to spend time with him. And, you know, of course, you know, it's been many, many stories about, you know, just many people who are helpful. And I know that your platform is about, you know, making life better for others who are less fortunate. So
that's correct. That's absolutely correct.
I appreciate that. And I admire that.
All right. So let's, the name of the podcast is Whispers and Bricks, and the whispers are those voices telling you like the right thing to do. And it represents the good things in life. The bricks represent the bad things that we go through in life. And there are many ups and downs and many bumps in the road. Now, from reading your bio, you seem to have had a incredible, incredible life, a great career. But like I said, you know, every so often we get hit with a brick. Now, my biggest brick was 9/11 and the whispers that helped me to get out and my miraculous escape. What my listeners want to know is, what were some of the struggles or failures, if there were any, of some of the bricks that you got hit with, either personally or professionally, when you were either starting out in your career or throughout your career?
So for me, I think at an early age, there was some physical injury that happened. I ended up severing the ligament in my right knee in a fall while I was playing sandlot football. And I fell and I slid through some glass and it just kind of cut my knee up. And I went home. And my mom takes, you know, alcohol and puts it on. And, of course, that didn't feel too good. Yeah. Because the flesh was showing. So then she took me to the doctor because she worked at a doctor's office. Took me to the doctor. We go to the doctor. And he said, you got to take him to the hospital. So we went to the hospital. And then they performed a surgery on my leg. And so I was probably maybe like 11 or 12. And, you know, so I had a cast on my leg and, you know, it took a lot of time for it to heal, several months for it to heal. And then once it was healed, like any time you get a cast anywhere on your body, you know, there's atrophy and the whole deal. So we looked at my leg and it looked like an arm. It looked like I had three arms and one leg or whatever. So I got all kinds of nicknames during that time, Hop Along and Peg Leg and, you know, whatever. The kids were kind of hard on me. And I went from being the fastest kid on the block to the slowest. And, you know, I felt like at that stage in my life, it was such a challenge to get back what I had lost. And, you know, I went at it in an interesting way. Because I just kind of used the things that were available to me, you know, the steps on my apartment house, the benches that were in the common areas, in the playground, there were swings and seesaws and all that kind of stuff. And I just remember going out and, you know, conditioning myself and training with those things. Not knowing what my future was, you know, I mean, I just knew that athletics were going to be in my future because I was basically in elementary school and then middle school. But all of those things became like gifts to me that I realized later doing those things, jumping over the benches and seesawing and flying out of the swings and, you know, all of that stuff. You know, there was a brick definitely laid on me with the fall.
Right.
But then in terms of the whispers or the miracle associated with being coming back and becoming, you know, a world-class athlete down the road, who knew, you know, and who knew, and developing late as opposed to developing early was very important too, because, you know, I mean, not a lot of people saw it coming. So at age 16, 17 and 18, I wasn't better than everybody. You know, but I worked probably harder than everybody. And it was always a state of catch up. And I think maybe I caught up when I was about 20.
Wow, that's so late.
So when I was 20, I caught up and I had a lot of things going for me at that time because I was a student athlete. And even my freshman year in college, I wasn't the leading scorer on the team. You know, the guy who came from Long Island. Like me, his name was Rick Bogley. He was the leading scorer on the team. I was the second leading scorer. And we had an undefeated season. So then the next year when I came back, and pretty much after that, all the way until my 15th year as a pro, I was always the leading scorer on the team. So it happened at age 20 when I got invited to be an Olympian and go into the Olympic development program as an alternate. But, you know, went and excelled in the training camp situation, went to Europe, Russia, Poland, and Finland, and played and led the team in scoring and rebounding. So I was a late bloomer, and that was good. So the brick, that brick early in my life, as well as the passing of my little brother when he was 16 and I was 19, you know, that was a brick. That was a brick. I thought I would never cry again. And I said I wasn't going to cry again. And then a couple years later, my favorite uncle died. And I found myself in the church, you know, reaching for napkins and tissues, you know, because the tears just became real. And crying is a real part of life. You know, it's just something that you need to do to cleanse yourself and purify yourself, just in terms of times of misery or trial or tribulation. And sometimes the tears are a good thing to shed. Sometimes there's good tears.
You know, I agree with you 100% on this point. I personally, I'm a very emotional type of individual, and I'll cry at the drop of a hat. But you know what? I look at that as a blessing. All right. Because when I see somebody who's in pain, all right, I can so empathize with them, and I can literally sit down and cry with them, because I'm just that type of personality. Yeah. I get overwhelmed, you know, and I try and help in any way I can, you know. So I view that as a blessing of and I'll tell, you know, like a grown man that is able to cry, all right, is a blessing. It's a true blessing, right? Because, you know, not everything is going to go our way, and you just have to thank God for what you have or what you had. Yeah. I mean, again, your brother, you know, passing away at the age of 16, you know, terrible, terrible tragedy, but you had him for 16 years.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You had him for 16 years.
There's something to think about in terms of the worthiness of it all. And with people going through trial and tribulation, you know, you have to recognize what their worth is. When I hear of a tragedy, plane crashing, let's say, a volcano exploding, a tsunami, or whatever, all those people, they have a worth, you know, and they have a value. And the fact that, you know, people get lost makes me sad. And sometimes to the point of crying, sometimes just watching a movie.
Yeah.
My eyes are well up and I just need to pat them down.
I'm okay. I'm not crying. I'm okay. Really crying.
Yeah. My eyes are watering. Yeah. So it's healthy. And we're both on the same page there, which is good.
Let me ask you this. Who could you point to as the person who had like the absolute most influence in your life? And why?
Well, my mom would be first and foremost. You know, she and my dad separated after my brother was born. So I was 3, my sister was 6, my brother was just born. They separated, eventually divorced. So she had to go the distance, you know, herself until she ended up remarrying probably when I was 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. And she married a much older gentleman who was my stepfather. But she was all in everything. And I think the thing that kept me out of trouble was not that I didn't have friends who got into trouble and did some crazy things or whatever, but I didn't want to make life harder for her than it already was. You know, she grew up in South Carolina. She got a teaching degree and was able to teach down there. When she came to New York, they wouldn't let her teach. So she did domestic work. And she did domestic work. She cleaned the doctor's office that our aforementioned doctor used to clean his office. And then she went and got a license to be a beautician and got a booth in a shop and, you know, had her own booth, had her own customers or whatever. And at the same time, she was raising 3 children. So I had never wanted to do anything to make her life more difficult and wanted to do things to make her proud of me. And, you know, I was able to do that by the grace of God. And, you know, it wasn't an exact plan because I didn't plan to go down when I went down. But coming up was through God's will and blessing. And, you know, the story, you know, here we are at age 71, you know, looking at the best day in my life to be in front of me because I just choose to do that. But I have had some tremendous days behind me, you know, and I don't take any of those for granted. But I still say tomorrow's going to be the best day.
You know, absolutely. Absolutely. You know what they say? Every day above ground is a good day.
There you go. Straight up.
Right. Yeah. So your mom, she must've been really something special, you know, just from your, you know, what you're telling me. I mean, that it's truly amazing. And you know what? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I mean, you're absolutely, you're an amazing individual. Let me ask you this.
Outside of the family, is there outside of the family question who was the best influence?
Not necessarily, but sure, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Who was it?
Okay. So outside of the family, my high school coach, Ray Wilson, Bill Russell, in terms of iconic figures, when he came to UMass and asked me to go to dinner with him after he had given an address that I couldn't attend because I had practice. And then he sat with me for 3 hours.
Wow.
And shared his story. William Ferdinand Russell, amazing guy. I mean, I love him like he's an uncle or brother, and he has returned the love. He extended the hand of friendship to me when I was 19 years old. And it's no coincidence that next year became my coming out year or whatever because of the confidence that was instilled in me, you know, by him just paying attention as he did. And, you know, we've continued to maintain a relationship since, what is that, 1969? Yeah, so that's 30, it's almost 50 years, it's plus 50 years plus.
Yeah.
Whatever, and you know who he is and what he did and what he stands for and what he stood for. So that's been a light in my life.
Wow. So before we go, let me ask you this. Do you have any words of wisdom or anything you want to share with my audience? Something they can walk away with and, you know, say, wow.
Of course. You know, you make your own luck. But in order to make your own luck, you know, you have to have a recipe. I'm making this up as I go along right now, okay?
That's fine.
So the recipe for me, I think, is getting an education and daring to be great. When others say you can't, you dare to be great. And you have the attitude that will give you the altitude in life and get you to higher places and, you know, have a more profound effect on those around you. So you kind of mix that up. That's your recipe right there. And, you know, just kind of move without fear. Move with, be respectful of things and be respectful of the dangers of society and life because there are real dangers out there. And, you know, whether it's Satan or others, you know, there's some bad people out there. There's some bad things that can happen. So protect yourself and protect your loved ones. It'd be good to have a protector, somebody who's got your back as you step and you walk through your journey in life, but walk through with a positive attitude. And, you know, I think things will turn out pretty good for you.
Wow. That's great. Julius, that is really, really great. Now, if anybody wants to get a hold of you for, you know, they want to hire you as a speaker or, you know, you do a lot of charity work, what would be the best way to get in touch with you? Is a website or an email or?
Yeah, we have a website and we have a website in development. We took down Dr. J Enterprises and we put up Irving Global Opportunity LLC, EGO LLC. Or whatever, but I'll send that to you and make sure that you have it on file. Because you know, we do get emails there right now, and we haven't developed the full website. But I, you know, people can usually find me. Yeah. I'm a public figure.
Yes, you are.
And that's not the hardest thing to do, finding Julius Erving.
That's for sure. I did have one more thing I wanted to ask you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is there any way, if people want to help you, to, you know, help those, that are less fortunate, those ABA players that, you know, mm-hmm. who were less fortunate, mm-hmm. how would somebody go about to, you know, mm-hmm. getting involved or, you know, helping yeah. with that, you know, yeah. what can we do? What can my audience do?
So right now there's a group of ABA people, and it's headed up by an attorney named Scott Tarter, and it's called Dropping Dimes Foundation. Dropping Dimes. Basketball, when you drop a dime, that's giving somebody an assist.
Right.
That's what they call. So it's the Dropping Dimes Foundation. Scott Tarter, Bob Nedelicki. I'm on the advisory board. Rick Barry's on the advisory board. Mm-hmm. Bob Costas is on the advisory board. And there's an effort through the Dropping Dimes Foundation to help these guys.
Oh, great.
So that would be great to reach out to them.
Reach out to them, yeah. donate over there and the yeah. like. Yeah. yeah.
They're based in Indianapolis.
That's great. Julius, thanks so much for sharing your story with my audience. It was truly an eye opener. I wish you all the luck in the world going forward. You know, what can I say? You're an iconic yeah. figure, but you're so humble. All right. And yeah. that's what draws me to you in the first place, yeah. you know, yeah. that you're just an amazing individual. And I really, really want to thank you and really lots of luck.
Yeah.
And to my audience, you've been listening to Whispers and Bricks, and I'm your host, Ari Shomer. Until next time, listen to the whispers, avoid the bricks,
so
and never give up on your dreams.
Of Whispers and Bricks. Head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.